For the week of February 28th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 314, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Riverdale, I'm Michael Giltz.
Riverdale, New York? Isn't that like up in the Bronx, Riverdale, New York?
No, it's the home of Archie Andrews from Archie Comics.
Okay, you're talking about like the fictitious Riverdale.
I am talking about the fictitious Riverdale because they got a TV show called Riverdale spun off from Archie Comics. They got a new Archie Comics comic books in the stores, bringing them up to date. They're always doing stuff with Archie Comics. I was a little freaked out by the casting notice for the TV show. I'm sort of interested because I have a friend who went to Riverdale, the real place inspired that helped inspire the comic strip.
And this is in the Bronx, right?
No. Well, I mean, I'm sure there's a Riverdale in the Bronx as well, but whatever. They went to Riverdale. They knew people there. They got the TV show. I'm all into it. New Zealander KJ Apa has been cast to play Archie Andrews. So that's cool. But what freaked me out was that playing Archie's dad is Luke Perry.
Can I tell you something? I'm going to admit something. When I saw you add that to the show notes, this story, and I saw Luke Perry's name, I thought to myself, well, it can't be the Luke Perry from Beverly Hills 90210. Okay, so I went
Did
back.
Did you think he's too old to play Archie's dad?
No. I just thought, well, I'm sure he looks young, right? And yeah. Is he old enough to play Archie's dad?
Oh, yeah.
And I actually went and looked up Luke Perry to see what he's been up to, what he's been doing.
How old is he?
What's he look like nowadays? Like, I realized I had spent like 10, 15 minutes in the world of Beverly Hills 90210 finding out what the cast is up to nowadays. And I just thought, gosh darn you, Michael Giltz.
And Luke Perry looks old enough to be a dad.
He does, yes.
And he's 49 years old.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. He's old enough to be a father of two, which I think he is a father of two.
I don't know. But yeah, so that makes you feel old.
Yes, it does.
The guy you watched debut on TV as a high school student is now playing the dad of a high school student.
Yes. Well, and I have to say, you might notice for those listening, Michael sounds a little under the weather. He is under the weather, and that might be because he single-handedly put the entire show notes together this week. This show was put together by Michael.
Well, don't blame me. It's more about the weather here in New York. It's hot, it's cold, it's hot, it's cold. It doesn't help.
Well, you know, if it helps, here in Los Angeles, it's hot, and then it's hotter, and then it's a little bit less hot, but it's still hot, and then it doesn't rain at all.
That's right, and you're all white.
That's true, pretty much. That is what I learned last night. There's only one African-American person in Los Angeles, and that is Chris Rock.
And Kevin Hart.
That is true. You're right. Chris Rock did point that out.
All right. So we're talking about the Oscars. What are we going to handle on this week's show?
Well, on this week's show, we're hoping, if all the stars align, we'll be able to catch up with Ann Thompson, editor-at-large of IndieWire, who attended last night's Academy Awards, a.k.a. the Oscars. You know, every year we have Ann on the day after the Academy Awards, and this year, you know, she's busy, but you know, she was there last night as a guest and as a journalist, and she's going to, hopefully, if we can catch her, try and bring some insight into what was one of the most wide-open Oscar races in recent memory, with 7 films winning top honors.
She was there as a guest?
Yeah, she was in the audience, and she was there covering...
Wasn't she there as a journalist?
Well, both, yeah. They do invite some journalists to actually sit in the audience.
But she was there as a journalist.
Yes, she was there as a journalist, so yes.
Oh, okay. I mean, she wasn't involved in a film, surely.
No.
Okay, so she was there as a journalist.
Yes,
she sat
correct.
In the audience, but she was there as a journalist.
As a journalist, and hopefully, okay. I know she's really busy today, but we're going to try and track her down. If not, it'll be Michael and I yammering on about this stuff, and, you know, I think we know a thing or two about a thing or two.
Keep going.
Not about the Oscars, but, you know.
Keep going.
Okay, well, Michael, you know that for sure. Award season never really ends, right? I mean, France handed out their own movie awards, so we'll touch on the Césars. We even look at the nominations for the Olivier Awards, and these are the London theater equivalent to the Tonys. Literally hours after winning his first Oscar, spoiler alert, by the way, Mark Rylance was nominated again. It must be nice. During Inside Baseball, we'll look at the publishing world. Barnes & Noble is planning to imitate Amazon with some new brick-and-mortar stores. That sounds completely odd and awkward. I can't wait to find out what the heck that's all about. The diversity issue comes to the French comic book industry, and a reissue of the Alex Haley bestseller Roots brings up everything from copyright to the question of when a book goes out of print to ebook pricing. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, We'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at the box office around the world. We pull our information from RenTrak. We have a link in our show notes. Also, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, Deadpool, for the third weekend in a row, I think. $71 million over the weekend. It passes the $600 million mark. It now has its eye on The Matrix Reloaded. That is the movie that grossed the most of any R-rated film in history worldwide. That's at like $730 million, something like that. Deadpool is going to blow past that number. Deadpool will become the highest grossing R-rated film of all time. If it opened to $71 million, that wouldn't be bad because it only costs $60 million to make. And yet it's already at $600 million.
Now, is that whole, all those figures, are those adjusted for inflation? Because I have to ask.
No, of course not. We never adjust for inflation.
I know,
that's stupid, but it's a nice thing to point out. But we're not talking about something from the 30s. We're talking about The Matrix Reloaded, which was what, 2000s, 900s? When was that?
That was 2003, 2004.
Right. Yeah, so it's a decade ago. So it's just a little bit of a difference, but still, it's going to handily beat The Matrix Reloaded. And number two around the world, this is fun. The Gods of Egypt, or is it just Gods of Egypt? I forget. I think there's no the.
There is
anyway,
no the.
This is a Lionsgate film. They were hoping to launch a new franchise. Flop opening weekend, no question about it. It grossed $38 million over the weekend worldwide. It cost $140 million to make. It got poisonous reviews. It did terrible here in North America. It opened in almost 70 territories, did badly in almost all of them, I believe. But here's the thing.
Wait, you said $140 million to make this movie?
That's what I said, except the studio said, no, wait. But never mind that. It only cost us 10.
Yeah.
Which has to be the fastest and quickest write down. No, we didn't spend 140. We spent 10. 10? And what they mean is they did spend $140 million to make it, but they sold it off in territories all over the world. You know, this country paid this amount, that country paid that amount. So, in fact, by the time it opened, they were covered to everything but $10 million. So it doesn't mean they didn't spend $100. They just said our exposure on this movie is only $10 million plus the $40 million we spent on marketing.
So their exposure is $50 million. And what I would say to all of those territories that purchased Gods of Egypt for their own movie theaters and the rights to DVD and streaming and television in their own territories. Well, guess what? It's in 69 territories. So this is a worldwide flop.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That's what happens. Every movie is new. Every movie is a roll of the dice. And number three is a Disney roll of the dice called Zootopia. This is a new Disney film. It's not Pixar. It's from the Disney Animation Division. And it's getting very good reviews and doing pretty damn well overseas. $30 million over the weekend. $80 million and counting. It seems to be getting good reviews, and it's going to open up here in North America, and we'll have to see how it pans out. And number four is The Mermaid. This is a monster smash hit from China. It's directed by Stephen Chow. It made $30 million over the weekend. It's at $490 million worldwide. Is that right? I thought it was even at $600 million, somebody was saying. It's barreling along. It's passing the $500 million mark. It's just a huge, huge hit. It's playing here in the U.S. on a few screens, playing in 8 territories officially. I wonder how wide it will go. I mean, how many other more countries? Will it play Australia? Will it play the U.K.? It's only in 8 territories. So once you get from Japan and the Asian markets in the U.S., there's got to be a lot of the world still available to The Mermaid.
Well, here's the thing. We're talking about it, correct? So we're talking about it. Mainstream media is talking about it. Okay, it's not just
us. Has it broken out to mainstream media?
Yeah, I mean,
you mean Variety and Hollywood Reporter?
Well,
you mean?
No, I'm talking about the LA Times and the New York Times. Now, when they talk about it, it's on page like 4 of the business section, but still, it's being covered. And so because of that, I think that it will help the word spread at least to Chinese communities, the Chinese diaspora. So no matter where they are.
Well, they know about it already, obviously.
You think, yeah, okay, yeah, all right.
And it ain't a secret. And number five is The Revenant, the Oscar-winning film that made $18 million over the weekend, $400 million worldwide. It cost $135 million to make. Leonardo DiCaprio was money in the bank. You want to make a film for adults. You want to make a movie on a difficult subject. You want to make a movie that isn't an obvious franchise or blockbuster thing, but you don't want to lose your shirt. Cast Leonardo DiCaprio.
You may want to explain that to Chris Rock. I don't think he understood that.
He understands. You make money with Kevin Hart, too.
Good point.
You make money with Ice Cube. You make money with Will Smith.
All, and number six, all, is, all true, by the way.
Yes, of course. At number six is Kung Fu Panda 3. Another $13 million over the weekend. $315 million worldwide. It's still not in the black, but it's got a ways to go. It's only in seven territories, so it has most of the world to go. It has become the highest grossing animated film in Chinese history. I don't normally like breaking stuff down. Highest rated comedy, highest rated R-rated film, highest grossing this. But, you know, animated versus live action is a big distinction, and it does have the crown now in China. It's the high. In fact, all three Kung Fu Panda films became the highest grossing animated film in Chinese box office history. So you would expect this one to do that, but it's done it. And the way they filmed the movie with doing different animation for the Mandarin language soundtrack, that may well become standard issue for movies down the road. That may be worth the extra 10 or 20 million you pay to do that.
I don't know why it wouldn't be already.
Well, it's true. You can do it for every territory in the world. You can do it for France. You're going to do it for Spain. You're going to do it for Latin American countries. I mean, you could do it for Spanish, but you know, how much did it cost to do? I don't know. They didn't really detail that out.
Last night during the Oscars, some animated characters, Woody and Buzz Lightyear from Toy Story, gave out Best Animated Feature. And I thought, oh, this should be interesting. How are they going to do the lip sync for who wins?
Well, normally they hide them behind the envelope so they can just dub in the voice. But in this case, they actually showed their faces.
And it was lip sync. And I guess maybe what they did was they said, all right.
They had them all set up and they just had a quick delay off stage. They opened up the envelope and then pressed the button for whichever one was right.
Correct. Yeah. That had to have been it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But that was a fun thing. Yeah. Cause normally they just raise the envelope and go, and the winner is. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. But so, I thought it worked.
So this is a great win for DreamWorks Animation. You know, they gambled a lot on China. They did a co-production. The Chinese government has just extended the film's run for another 30 days. So it's not going to be kicked out of theaters in China. It can keep running for another month. That means it'll make pretty much every penny it can. It still has most territories in the world to open up in. So by the time Kung Fu Panda 3 is done, and that's why we look at worldwide box office, this is going to be a significant success story for DreamWorks Animation. It was a good week for them, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, they had their best revenue in for nearly a decade in 2015. Analysts expected them to report 16 cents a share. They reported 55 cents. They actually made money, and they were expected to lose 15 million, but they earned $7.6 million in net income. Can you imagine? You run a studio. Hey, we made $7 million. That sounds so modest. But hey, it's better than losing money.
Well, as Katzenberg, Jeffrey Katzenberg, the head of DreamWorks Animation, pointed out, he said the studio delivered its best top-line result in 11 years and highest revenue growth in 8 years. And that's another way of saying, look, Wall Street, if you're not happy with that, you'll just never be happy.
Exactly, exactly. So a great week for them. I would love to get some information on how much it cost to do that Mandarin language reanimation. It wasn't just the lips and the mouth. Sometimes they did whole body movements to coincide with the, you know, the language so that it would feel more natural and believable. So I'd love to get info on that. At number 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And number 7 around the world is How to Be Single, another $11 million. That's at $60 million and counting. At number 8, some more movies that came out during the Chinese New Year. The Monkey King 2, another $8 million. It's slowing down. It's at $180 million worldwide. And number 9, this is a good little success story. This is Risen, the biblical procedural film, a sort of a comeback for director Kevin Reynolds. It grossed another $7 million over the weekend, and it's now grossed its budget. It cost $20 million to make, and in North America, it's grossed $22 million. I don't know what its market is like overseas, but at least they've made, you know, that symbolic amount. You want to triple it, of course, worldwide, but it's a good start for them. And number 10 is Triple Nine. This is a heist movie with cops going bad. It stars Casey Affleck and Chiwetel Ejiofor. It's John Hillcoat. He's a good director, but it had a modest opening weekend. $6 million over the weekend, $8 million total. And number 11 is Pattaya. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. It's a city in Thailand, but it's a wacky French comedy about dudes on vacation. And it had a modest opening with $6 million. And looking down, I do want to touch on Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. We mentioned that last weekend. It grossed another $5 million. It's at $36 million and counting, playing in two territories, which I assume is China and... I mean, is Hong Kong... I can never remember. Is Hong Kong a separate territory?
It's a separate territory, but it is part of China.
It is legally, but whether they count it as a market.
Yes, it's a separate market.
Okay. So it's playing in China and Hong Kong, I assume. It's grossed $36 million so far. We don't know what the Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon sequel cost. At one point, this would have been a massively huge deal if, you know, Ang Lee had been involved in the top people and they'd done it at the time. I mean, this was the highest grossing internet foreign language film in North American history. It was a big worldwide hit. Now this movie has come out in these few territories. It's gotten mixed reviews many years later. And suddenly, out of nowhere, we were waiting and debating and talking what was going to happen to this movie in North America. Would it be day and date? Would it be on IMAX screens only? What would happen? There was all this controversy. Guess what? They just started streaming it on Netflix. They just I just saw a bus ad saying it's now on Netflix. I'm like, what? Like, they didn't even release it in theaters in North America.
Yeah, well, yeah, the American exhibitors that own IMAX theaters said, yeah, no, okay, we're not going to do that because we're on a rev share, so no.
But then they have, like, they had some that they believed they'd cracked the code and some were going to do it and some had deals where they could do it and it was going to happen, right? I mean, this was announced very gaudily as a big deal and it all fell apart.
Yeah,
Machinations must be fascinating on this one. It's a shame. I wish the movie were better. From the reports, it's not great. I wish I'd been able to see it on the big screen. I wish Ang Lee had directed it, and I wish it had come about many years ago. I'm the only one who cares. I thought it was fascinating. I thought the fact that this was going to be one of the groundbreaking, path-breaking movies ended up being, you know, ending with a whimper rather than a bang was pretty. I was shocked. I kept wondering, when is it coming out? When is it coming out? And suddenly I walked by a bus depot and there's a sign saying, yeah, it's already on Netflix.
Yeah, they definitely did not handle the announcements and the theatrical distribution.
Make sure you
properly.
Got people in place before you announce what's happening with it.
Exactly. And they thought that they could force the hand here and it did not work.
And this really has to make you, I mean, obviously Netflix and Amazon and others were all buying big at the film festivals. Really has to make you think twice, right? If you want your movie in a theater, you know, you're going to want some serious contract clauses saying this needs to get a full theatrical release without streaming day and day. I mean, you know, if you want to be seen and be eligible for awards.
Well, remember, IMAX actually does own certain theaters where they themselves are the exhibitor. Okay,
right, so they didn't do it this time, did they?
Well, I think...
I'm just talking more about Netflix. You want, if Netflix picks up your movie, what's going to happen to it? It's going to be like Beast of No Nation and Crouching Tiger. It's just going to come and go without, you know, being seen in a theater. Does that matter? Maybe lots of people are streaming it. Maybe people are happy to watch it. Maybe they're loving it.
Well, remember, Birth of a Nation, which is the film that won the Sundance. Yeah, it's the film that won Sundance this year. Okay.
They were offered Netflix. That's right.
They were offered $20 million. They turned it down and took a $17 million offer to go to Fox Searchlight. Why? Because of that very
I know. And I'm just saying this is yet another example of why this may long-term really hurt Netflix if they don't figure this out. If you're making a movie and you want to be seen in a movie theater at all, but you know, you're a documentary, you're a small film, maybe you'll reach a wider audience by streaming right away on Netflix rather than going to a movie theater. But hell, I didn't even know it was on Netflix. Maybe if you go on and log in every day, they would have had banner ads splashing it about and you would have known, no question about it. But I don't know. I think it's disturbing.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how their business model regarding theatrical releases evolves. But they definitely don't want to give movie theaters the upper hand and say, well, no, you know, it's more prestigious if it's there first, because they want to see themselves as the most prestigious platform.
Well, but that's stupid. If you invest in a movie and you can make more money and you'll have a bigger audience for it once it reaches Netflix by showing it in theaters and getting acclaim and getting box office, what the heck's wrong with that? That doesn't diminish you. You made it happen. HBO films get released all over the world, right?
They do. As a matter of fact, Behind the Candelabra, which was an HBO film and on HBO here in the United States, was released theatrically in Europe. So
yes. Yeah, so, you know, it's just what works best for every territory, what works best for you and the people in it. But I do think they're going to have trouble keeping attracting talent if big movies disappear like that. You know, contract deals come up when movies flop a lot, and they come up when movies are big successes, and that's what happened with Deadpool. Now that this movie is hitting big, suddenly we're getting some details about how they made that movie for $60 million. Turns out Ryan Reynolds was paid $2 million, but he got a back end, and he should reap $10 million and maybe even more once the movie hits certain levels, like $800 million worldwide, which it's sure to do. Director Tim Miller, he got $250,000. Pretty exciting. One level of bonus kicks in for him if the movie hit $150 million gross in North America, which it did in its first 4 days.
Yeah. And notice how these things are now, look, we're not looking for back end, okay? We're looking for bonuses based on performance.
Right. That's guy. Nobody can argue about, you know.
Oh, it didn't make money. It did make money. No, we're looking right. at the everybody's going to report on the theatrical gross, okay? Not
you
net.
Can't hide that.
Yeah. And so if you notice, there's a big trend into bonuses versus
that's
net.
That's been a long time, right?
Well, yeah, there's always been little bumps, but now it's becoming more and more prevalent. And I think that the studios kind of don't mind that. You know why? Because 20 years from now, when that film is still bringing in $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 a year on, you know, yeah, television and streaming or whatever it's going to be at the time.
Nobody's going to be asking for their money.
Exactly. They own it in perpetuity. They don't have to worry about everybody with their hands in their pot. Yeah. So it's
less fights, less fights.
Exactly.
And what else did they do to keep everybody happy?
Wait, who are you referring to now? Hollywood
Deadpool,
in general?
The studio for Deadpool. Well, they gave bonuses to the writers. They didn't have to, technically, but they want to keep the team in place. They've got the director, the star, the writers. And so, you know, when a movie hits extraordinarily big, they're like, yeah, here you go. Here's another $20. You know, they hand out cash or toys or gifts to people to say, yeah, we recognize that the money you were paid doesn't remotely reflect the hit you delivered. And we want you to show our goodwill and our love and affection. So they spread the love all around, didn't they?
Well, yeah. And that's actually quite common for writers to get.
Here's a Jeep.
Yeah. Well, they're usually it's about a $50,000 to $100,000 bumps where, okay, if it reaches $40 million on a certain budget, okay, here's $100,000. And I can tell you this much, that on Monday morning, the Monday morning after a film is reportedly with the flash grosses to reach $40 million or whatever that benchmark, that milestone is, the writers are calling their agents. Almost always, it's the writers that pick up the phone. When I was at CAA or in William Morris, the writers were the first people on the phone Monday morning saying, okay, can you call the studio and get the check cut for the bonus?
They don't make a lot of money.
Exactly.
IMAX makes a lot of money, though, didn't they? Just like DreamWorks Animation, they had an annual report about the status of IMAX, the screens and all that stuff. What did they say?
Well, they said, we are big. We're huge. And that's kind of funny because, you know, it's a big screen. See, that's okay. Well, look, they've got 529 theaters operating under revenue sharing arrangements, which is up, okay, from 451. So they've added about
worldwide.
Yeah, that's worldwide. They've added 78 screens and they have a per screen average for the entire year of $1,155,000.
So what is this?
Yeah,
I'm familiar with per screen averages for like a weekend or for a particular movie. But what do they mean a per screen average for the year? They mean saying each on average, their screens gross that much over the entire year.
Correct. So it's about $22,000 per week. Now, when you look at a movie screen like, a multiplex movie screen, you might say, yeah, but Star Wars made that in 1 weekend. Yeah, 1 weekend. Okay. But then the next week, they made $400. So what are you going to do? So on average, they're making $22,000 per week. It's not bad.
Mm-hmm. So what do you mean this revenue sharing arrangement? 529 theaters worldwide, branded IMAX, under a revenue sharing arrangement. That just means IMAX screens in a movie theater chain?
Right. So they don't own those. It's basically the films
play.
Well,
which ones do they own? Aren't they revenue sharing arrangements with museums as well? Aren't those?
Some of those are actually outright owned by IMAX. So IMAX comes in, they install everything, they pay for it.
They just say, we'll put in an IMAX screen and you'll bring in more people to your museum. Is
exactly.
that the idea?
Exactly.
Okay. So worldwide, what did they do last year?
$1 billion in box office.
What is the worldwide box office? The North American was like $11 billion. What was worldwide? Was it $50 billion?
I think 35.
They're $35 billion. So they're 3.3% of the whole.
Yes, and that's just IMAX.
So I don't understand. So there's 529 theaters, but there's 943 total. So what are the other 400? They're all planetariums and zoos,
Or they're standalone. Meaning that, yes, it's at a commercial multiplex, but it's an actual IMAX screen that they built at the commercial multiplex.
Oh, I don't know of many of those.
Yeah, I know of at least three or four in the Los Angeles area.
All right. But there's also more IMAX screens coming. 372 theater systems are on order. That's the true. Backlog that they have. So they could increase by 30% if they could just build them quickly.
Well, and a part of that is there are zones for IMAX, so they don't allow an IMAX theater to be built across the street from another IMAX theater.
Well, that's these are ones that are approved and ready to go.
Yes,
this is not a question of one that can't be built. These are ready to go. They just, it's backlog. It takes some time to build them.
Yeah, well, and it also takes the exhibitors time to build those theaters too. So very often what will happen is a new build will be announced.
They'll be building a mall or something, yeah.
Right, and they'll say, okay, well, we cut a deal with IMAX, so when we build it, IMAX will build out that screen, we'll build out the other 9, 10, 11,
etc. That's a natural delay. A lot of this, though, is just a backlog, isn't it? There's more demand than they can fulfill right now. If they could build these quicker, most of them are ready to go, they're ready to be built, they just haven't done it yet.
Part of that 372 is both the natural backlog and the backlog. So, yeah.
The backlog.
Yeah.
Well, are you going to invest in IMAX?
I don't invest in any stock, any industry stock.
Would you if you could?
No.
You think it's a good buy? What about Viacom? Because they're looking to sell a piece of Paramount. At one point, we thought maybe they would just sell Paramount outright. That's what some investors are calling for. But now they just want to sell off a piece of it.
Yeah, and I don't know why they would do that. I mean, it's kind of
spread the risk and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, they can do that another way.
And they want to be
with
a strategic partner. They want to be with a strategic partner who's going to help them in some way, like maybe some Chinese company.
Yeah, that's pretty much what they're saying there. There are other ways to do that, but to spread the risk, that is. And slate financing deals being one of them. Yeah, I don't know what's going on over there. Look, Paramount is going through some transitions. Let's face it.
But why you wouldn't think a media company would want to own a movie studio is beyond me.
Yeah, just ask Comcast, in fact.
Well, it's time for the Oscars, isn't it?
Well, actually, last night was time for the Oscars. Now it's time to talk about what happened last night at the Oscars. Anybody that listens to this show on a regular basis, which is pretty much everybody that listens to this show, because
we have loyal listeners.
That's true. Yes, everybody knows that every year after the Oscars, we talk to one person and one person only. And it's not somebody, it's not Cheryl Boone Isaacs, it's not one of the winners, it's always Ann Thompson from IndieWire. And once again, and this is how busy she is. She's filing, and then she's racing to meetings, and then she's headed off to see Hamilton in New York, and then she's headed to South by Southwest. Ann Thompson, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. It wouldn't feel right without you.
So, I guess what happened last night, there were like supposedly the closest race in 21 years or in the 21st century, three films, all, it was a horse race all the way to the end with Spotlight, in my opinion, being a little bit of a surprise winning.
That's
Best Picture.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you get mad at yourself for second guessing, but I don't think, I mean, and I did really badly on my office pool and in my predictions, and I apologize to anybody who lost because of me. I'm so sorry. But I had good reasons, I think, insane reasons for everything that I did. For example, I knew that Mad Max was going to win a lot of the technicals. I just didn't think it would win as many. But I thought it might win Best Director, which it didn't, because they finally went with Inarritu for the second win. But they didn't go all the way and give The Revenant Best Picture, which would have represented a much bigger win for that movie. And finally, I think it always comes down. I mean, we can argue about the vagaries of the preferential ballot and who put it what at number one and who put what at number two, which we will never know. But finally, it always comes down to which movie do most Academy members want to represent Hollywood to the world. And in the end, I believe that The Revenant was a violent action picture, even though they campaigned and turned it into a work of art, which it was. But in the end, both Mad Max and The Revenant were violent action pictures. And the honorable drama that was fighting for justice, took the crown.
Well, couldn't you make the same argument for a movie like Unforgiven?
Unforgiven managed to be both things, which is what they were trying to do with The Revenant, which was to be an art film that was also an action film. That was fighting, the good fight. There was something about the way that The Revenant, the way that Unforgiven commented on the violence of the American West that was about us, that was about America. And I think The Revenant tried to do the same thing, but it didn't quite get to where Unforgiven did in the end.
Well, you mentioned Iñárritu. This is his second director win, you know, best director. He won last year for Birdman, this year for The Revenant, joining John Ford and Joseph Mankiewicz, the only two directors to ever do that. I guess he gave this rousing speech. What was that like hearing? You were in the audience. What was it like
in
hearing
the mezzanine?
In the mezzanine, yeah. What was it like hearing that?
Well, first of all, they were trying to play him off.
That was the worst part about last night's telecast, was the producers never knew when to actually hold
they
playing
were terrible.
People off.
I mean, I actually think that the music cues in general and the sound cues were all lead footed. I didn't even like the announcer. You know what I mean? And finally, it looked good though. I mean, they moved it right along. I think on the visual side, they had a good, solid, gorgeous Oscar show. And I thought Chris Rock did a great job. But when Iñárritu was making his speech, it was hard to hear. I had to watch it on the TV at the end of the night. To really get the gist of what he was saying, and it was a great speech, but it didn't play in the house because it was being ground out.
Did you watch the whole show on TV, did you, later?
I only watched like the last half hour.
Yeah, because visually I thought actually it was a very poorly done show, going in and out of commercials. There were just a lot of dead spots and awkward cues and dead, you know, it was just not terribly well done.
That's
I didn't think it was a very successful night. They messed up Lady Gaga's intro. They messed her up on the Grammys with bringing on a light too soon. In this show, they messed up with the camera work. And there's like you saw the guy holding up the window that we're peeking through. It's like, it was.
I know, you could see that on the stage. And I wondered how that would play. That's very interesting. Well, there is a difference then. When I was watching the part that I saw, I thought the way they did the panels, the vertical panels behind the, the big acting nominations, I thought those looked really good. And I liked the way Cate Blanchett sort of walked and talked into the camera and everything. I thought with the costume mannequins, I thought that was cool also.
Well, you know, it opened with Chris Rock, who, of course, had to address this whole Oscar so white controversy of the Academy not having diversity and all of the leading actors and supporting actors being Caucasian and white. So what did he, I mean, he basically gave this, I'd say, 10-12 minute monologue on the issue. And how did that play in the room from where you were sitting?
It played really well. I mean, what was interesting to me was the way that he walked the line, and he must have worked very hard, and the various players probably all weighed in, but he had to walk a line where he was, you know, performing this massive mea culpa on behalf of the Academy, but also explaining what putting it in context and getting laughs and not offending anybody. And still playing in the room with the industry insiders. And it did work, I thought. I thought he did a masterful job. Now, it had terrible ratings, but I wouldn't blame Al Sharpton's boycott or Chris Rock for the ratings. I would say that the films themselves, you know, are usually the ratings drivers.
And it was the lowest rating. Michael, you have those numbers.
And lowest rated in, well, we just have overnight. It's lowest rated in 8 years and perhaps the second lowest of all time.
Yeah.
But still the biggest non-sports event of the year. You know, still it's going to reach 34 million people and it will be number two for the year after the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's just relative, really.
Yeah. But it was we're talking about the insiders in Hollywood. It was an interesting night for two companies. One is Open Road and the other is A24. Open Road launched just 5 years ago. And
not even 4 years ago.
And it was launched by movie theater chains. And people are like, who's going to want to show their movies in a movie theater? Who's going to want to accept them? And here they are winning Best Picture faster than almost anyone else ever has done in history.
Yeah, I made that point. It's true. And Tom Hortonberg is the responsible party because he actually stuck to his guns. You know, unlike Harvey Weinstein, who sort of bailed on Carol at a certain point after getting into 6 nominations but no Best Picture nod, what struck me was that Hortonberg was just steady as they go, playing by the old Weinstein playbook, you know? Spending money, going for it, not giving up, and they got there by keeping the focus on how important and grave and incredibly crucial this movie really was, celebrating a journalistic expose, which was trying to protect the weak from a powerful institution. And people really responded to that. I just wish I'd stuck to my guns, because at the beginning I thought it was a natural for a Best Picture contender. But when I realized it was only going to win one, there were so few precedents for that. It happened very rare, like 21 years ago or something.
No, 60 years ago, The Greatest Show on Earth in 1952 won Best Picture and Best Story. The same thing, a screenplay award and Best Picture. And that was 63, 64 years ago.
Wow. Well, that's why I didn't predict Spotlight for Best Picture, even though I thought they would love it.
Well,
Years a Slave had more than that, you know, and her author, you know, which are sort of equivalent, smaller scale kind of movies.
But, and as much as The Big Short came in, you know, as one of the front runners, it wins one award now.
One award.
Yeah. I mean, so in a way, they spread the love around the voters this year.
They really did, and it was a very close race. When you have a situation where SAG Ensemble goes to Spotlight and PGA goes to The Big Short, which you can say showed that The Revenant was weak, which all of us wondered about. But I just figured the producers didn't want to, you know, reward Revenant for being badly produced. You know, it was like the nightmare production of all time, you know. But the directors did want to write rewards in Eureka, and the tech awards all went to Mad Max. And at one point, I thought maybe we could get director, you know, George Miller, but it was not to be.
Or maybe, I guess cinematography wasn't going to win because you were up against, you know, Ed Lachman and Lubezki.
Lubezki had to win, yeah. Lubezki had to. He still deserved it, too, you know. They all did. This is one of the most competitive cinematography fields I've ever seen. I mean, you know, really, you know, even, you know, for them to shut out Janusz Kaminski for Bridge of Spies, you know, it must have been very close.
Well, this was this year. Apparently, Universal spent $8 million on its Oscar campaign for The Revenant.
That would have been Fox.
I mean, Fox spent $8 million on The Revenant, and that's money well spent, isn't it? Because it was big at the box office.
Well, they're going on DVD right now. They're already promoting three Oscar wins. You know, rent your movie now. You know.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's the question that I have for you. How? I mean, it seems to me that the Oscar season is getting longer and longer. And it's just like, it's worse than the American presidential race. What in the world? I mean, has it changed in your mind as somebody who's covering it on a day-to-day basis?
It has changed into a much more intense marathon of campaigning than every year. They get better at it on some level. They all figure out new angles and they go. I do believe that campaign reform is absolutely necessary. This guy, Ira Deutschman, who many of you know from New York, a Columbia professor, head of their film department, he basically wrote an eight-step proposal for how the Academy can deal with its diversity issue, but it also involves fixing the campaign problems. There's way too much of it, way too much hobnobbing, and it's horrible for the actors and all the talent who have to go through it. I think that also any system that yields an Oscar win for the worst James Bond song in decades is, there's something wrong, you know, with it. Because you know, with the songs, it's all just campaigning and money and it just feels corrupt.
Well, there was no good song that could win Best Song because they were all dreadful songs. But the fact is, as one friend who got it right on her Oscar ballot says, and all credit to her, she looked at the list and said, that's the only song and the only movie anyone's seen. And so that's why she picked it.
And all the men voted for it too, you know, as opposed to the Lady Gaga song, which I thought was actually a good song and very moving on the telecast.
I felt very uncomfortable with that. I know it was well-intentioned, but I just felt like, oh.
Bringing all the rape victims out there was too much for you.
Yeah, I mean, that did seem to be, you know, the people I were watching the telecast with said, you know, enough already with the diversity. We get it. You've made your point. not every other line has to be about it. And the fact that you're kind of, it sounded and seemed like overkill, at least on television. What was it like there?
The Lady Gaga thing played really well in the house. And it was very moving. I didn't think of that as a diversity thing.
No, it's not a diversity issue at all.
No.
If anything, Spotlight and Hunting Ground related to each other.
No, I guess I'm talking about the issue, the issue of diversity coming up again and again and again beyond the opening monologue.
Yeah, I think what you had in general with Sherilyn Isaacs as the Academy president was a situation where perhaps she was overreacting to everything. But I don't want to criticize her because it was their right to try to deal with it, and their right to try to make fixes and amends and to see if they can do anything. Their right to raise consciousness in the universe of Hollywood. If she can help, if this whole thing can help change the rules of how people play the game and who they hire and raise consciousness about being more diverse in their hiring, that's a good thing. And I can see some signs that the needle is moving, even if it's very small.
I did find it interesting, at least on television. They ended the telecast with Fight the Power, which is
yeah, that was cool.
NWA, right?
That's Run DMC from the Spike Lee film.
Oh, it's Public Enemy.
Public Enemy
from Do the Right Thing.
All right, everybody, we are white people, except for Michael.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, Public Enemy from Do the Right Thing. It's a Spike Lee film. He didn't show up. That was a big deal. And I thought, I didn't know whether it was kind of a dig at him or
no,
just...
No, it wasn't a dig. It was fun. It was a little diversity plug.
Well, here's the most important question we have is did you buy Girl Scout cookies?
You know, that's sort of... I'd have to look at the telecast again at home and see how it played. It seemed to take up an awful lot of space, but it seemed to play well to the people sitting around me as a sort of folksy, fun kind of, shtick.
Well, certainly, it's always a pleasure to speak with you after the Oscars. In fact, I don't know if it would be an Oscar season without talking to you after the Oscars. And I know you're running from one meeting to the next and filing coverage, so we really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. Everybody should be following.
I hope I was slightly coherent.
Well, after last night, absolutely.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Anne.
Well, that was nice of Anne to join us, Michael. The very last minute. And
barely. Barely. Yeah. Squeezed her in between racing from one meeting to the next.
Yeah, yeah. We will place links to all of her work in our show notes and all of her coverage from the Oscars in our show notes.
Of course, the Academy Awards weren't the only movie honors handed out this week.
Go ahead.
We also had the Césars, didn't we?
Oh, I see what you were doing. I thought you were going right into the Oliviers. Yes, the César Awards, which are, I hate to do this, but everybody says, oh, they're the French equivalent of the Academy Awards. No, they're the French awards for movies.
Well, the Academy Awards came first.
Okay, so everything then becomes compared to the Academy Awards, but...
That's right. If you're first, you're best.
I guess.
And their best film of the year was Fatima.
Okay.
And the Oscar nominee, Mustang, it was not able to beat out Son of Saul, but it did win best first film at the Césars, so good for them.
Okay. Any other big winners that we want to mention there, or do we want to really move into the Olivier Awards?
Well, it's really just to say, my God, these awards just keep coming. I mean, we got the Tonys in June. The Oliviers have been announced. This is the British Award for the Best Theater of the Year. And just like the Tony Awards, it goes from like fall to spring.
But it's the Best Theater of the Year in
London.
In London, right. So I just wanted to try and delineate the difference between the Tonys and the Olivier Awards.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so they've just announced all their nominations for Best New Musical, Best Musical Revival, Best New Play, Best Play Revival, Best Comedy. They even have a thing called Best Entertainment and Family. So they have lots of categories where they want to cover everybody. So whereas Hand to God, which played on Broadway, is a sort of a scandalous black comedy that didn't get nominated for Best Play, but it did get nominated for Best Comedy. I'm not sure if you can get placed in both or not. So there's a lot of overlap. There's shows that will come to Broadway, like Gypsy, that got nominated for Best Musical Revival. It stars Imelda Staunton, and she will win Best Actress. There's no question about that. And she's coming to Broadway with that show. I'm very excited because everyone I know who saw it in London said it was just absolutely unbelievable. So, you know, some shows go to Broadway. Other Broadway shows come to London, like In the Heights. Lin-Manuel Miranda is, of course, excited about possibly winning Tony Awards in June for his show Hamilton. But now his previous Tony winner, In the Heights, has just debuted in the West End, and it's doing well. It got nominated for Best New Musical and all sorts of stuff.
He's like the Midas touch guy. You know, like everything he touches turns to gold these days.
Just like Mark Rylance, as we mentioned. Mark Rylance, there he is in America winning the Oscar and not giving a poem. I was really looking forward to a poem. But now here he is in London getting nominated for his performance in a play, a revival of, I think it's called, what is it called? It's a new play, Farinelli and the King.
Okay.
So he's the lead in that. I believe he plays Farinelli. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's true. And he's up for an Olivier. He's won them before. He'll win them again.
Do you think he will win this year for Farinelli?
No, I'm not saying that. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen him.
All right.
We've got Benedict Cumberbatch for Hamlet. He's nominated for Best Actor. So there's lots of good stiff competition. It's not a lock, but he's certainly a beloved fixture in the London theater scene and has won before and will win again.
To win or not to win. Okay, never mind.
Okay, here we go. And now big deal, big one.
Okay, so I guess you're saying, it's a big deal. These Olivier Awards for London, maybe not for the New York theater scene. Who knows? But it's
time. No, it is because, there's that back and forth. New York theater people go to London and get love. London people, their shows that get love come to New York. So we have Frank Langella in The Father. That's up for best play in the Oliviers. And all this sort of attention for that show lets us know when The Father comes to New York, which it is in a few weeks, pay attention.
So they are a big deal, which means it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about PBS. Apparently, PBS looked at the cable channels, Nick Jr., which launched in 1999, and Disney Jr., which launched in 2011, and decided better late than never. So it's turning the tyke-friendly programming block PBS Kids, and PBS stands for Public Broadcasting System. So they're turning PBS Kids into a 24-hour-a-day option that local stations can use as a digital cable channel and live stream. It will include shows like Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. That's hard to pounce. I think
apparently you don't have any 3-year-olds in your life.
Well, and if I did, they probably couldn't pronounce it either. Nature Cat is another show, while Kailu. Oh, gosh, that show, Kailu. Well, that remains available on Sprout, which is yet another cable channel, and one that PBS owns a stake in, by the way. So Sprout and PBS kind of have a relationship. Big deal or big whoop on all this PBS stuff?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course. They're just extending the brand. It's long overdue, though, to be fair. They are involved in Sprout as well. But, you know, at least they're doing it now.
Now, this next story could have been something we put in Inside Baseball because it is something that a lot of folks are talking about here in the entertainment industry. And if you want to track the fall of physical video in both sales and rentals, you can just...
And by that, we mean like DVDs and Blu-rays and stuff like that.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you could really, as those fall, you can track the rise of Netflix. They're, you know, and similar streaming services. It's just the point of the spear for streaming, which includes Hulu and video on demand and DVRs and so on, as we just said. But the link is pretty clear. After Netflix launched, physical video has taken one direct hit after another. And that's after they launched their streaming service. When people have access to the libraries of Netflix and Amazon Prime and so on, the need to buy or even rent actual DVDs and Blu-rays just isn't there. After all, if you're bored, you can start binge-watching Friends, so why bother with buying stuff? Or, you know what, you could go and watch a Breaking Bad. Maybe you haven't seen it yet, and you want to know what all the fuss is about, and you get caught up in it. The DVD rental sites Redbox are on the ropes, and overall sales on rentals have fallen from $21 billion to $17 billion. So that's like a 20% drop, and that includes Netflix, so the drop in physical video is even bigger. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, isn't it? I mean, it's natural, it's obvious. And I would imagine the fall might have even been tracked before when they were doing their DVDs. Because while they were paying for those DVDs and that was helping prop up the business, it was changing it dramatically, wasn't it? Because people, instead of going to the local Blockbuster or buying stuff, were just getting, you know, paying $8 a month and getting an access to a big library.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. And these are anecdotal and coincidental. But coincidentally, I should say, I spoke with several people this past week, like three different...
Been talking to people a lot lately.
I have been, yes. Three different colleagues who used to be in the, you know, sales rep business. They would represent films to, you know, different territories or to... They basically be an agent for a film, you know, a sales rep. And they were distributors, so they distribute films to theaters and on all of these different platforms, and they're getting out of the business. Some have gotten out already, and they said, look, you know what? DVD and digital rights, all this stuff, that we were like the big part of the iceberg underneath the water. You never really saw us. You didn't really notice us, but we
The studios kept quiet about it, but they at one point they made more money on DVD and Blu-ray than they did at the box office.
Yeah, but these folks, they're rarely dealing with studio stuff, okay? They're dealing with a lot of, I don't want to say independent, but lower budget films that aren't the big blockbusters that then get sold off in different territories. They're all the films that when you go to Cannes, Michael, you know, there's that market there.
Right.
That's what they're dealing in.
All that stuff.
Yeah. They're getting out of the business because they said, you know what? What used to be, you know, a 10, 20% margin, now we're actually barely breaking even. Barely. And we can, you know, it's questionable.
So why are you saying that smaller indie films, low budget flicks, the B movies, why are they being crushed? Because of these streaming libraries?
Yeah. Yes. Because
I thought there would be demand for them because to fill up the libraries that they have a lot of stuff to offer.
There is to some extent. However, what it used to be, a transaction and purchase economy, where you would actually go out and spend $7 to rent the DVD or $3.99 to rent the DVD, is now just something on Netflix. It'll get streamed. Somebody will make 50 cents, and that's that. Well,
and the people at their end make so much less. So it's just sort of the equivalent to music streaming.
That's absolutely correct.
Where the artist used to make a sale. But now, and lower people could maybe make some money, and now your margins are so much smaller because the actual money that's coming to you is so much less.
That's right. So when all of the artists are saying, we're not making any money, well, the labels are saying, yeah, well, we're not making any money either, so we have to try and keep as much money as possible before we give it to you. And yeah, it's the same concept. But now it's really driving people out of the business.
Well, but if those low budget, low rent, no good movies that nobody really cared about anyway don't get made, is that such a loss? I'm not trying to be,
well,
you know,
I'll
there's
say
a lot
this.
Of crappy junk that used to be made that filled up the pipeline that, you know, that's, it was amusing. It was fun. You see a funny poster, but like, really, you know, is that, I mean, there's lots of movies being made.
You know,
is
what?
That really
some,
lost?
To some extent, yes. To some extent, I see what you're saying, but I will say, you know what? Not everybody starts off by making The Revenant. Okay.
Well, no, of course, it's Roger Corman, you know, that's right. How a lot of people got their start making those. Yeah, but those movies got seen and played in theaters or whatever. There's a lot of movies you think they never appeared anywhere. There was a period when people were making so much money on DVD and Blu-ray, and previous to that VHS, that stuff got made just because they wanted to put some titles on shelves.
Yes, and now there are no shelves, so what's it matter? And you know what? I bought a brand new TV. First time in 14 years that I've purchased a TV, okay? And this thing, it brushes my teeth for me. It gets me dressed in the. I mean, this thing does everything. And but you know what the kids love is the fact that there's Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, and they can just, and YouTube. They love
it's
YouTube
like
even
channel.
More.
It's like they can just go to it. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like, oh, let's see what we can watch tonight. You know, now we only let them watch TV, you know, on Friday nights and Saturday nights. So they want to watch a movie. They start looking at Amazon or Netflix, and you know what? If they're looking for something and it's not there, they'll just find something else to watch. And they'll say, oh, well, let's watch this other one that we just ran across. So they're not going out and saying, okay, let's rent this other thing on VOD and actually create an economic transaction.
Which is what people did at Blockbuster.
Correct.
You know, same thing.
Yeah.
Interestingly, though, Netflix, we got to get off this, but Netflix mentioned streaming, mobile streaming. How much of that is happening? They say just 10% of their viewing comes on mobile, and that means phones and tablets and stuff like that. So, you know, it will rise, it will get bigger, but people, vast majority of the time, are still watching movies on probably large laptops or on TVs.
Yes, and I have to say, now that I have one of these smart TVs, it's unbelievable. Do you know how much content there is out there that you have access to now? I'm going to cut the cord.
Keep going.
Okay. Walt Disney is one of the most successful, if not the most successful, theme park attractions in the world. And guess what? They're embracing surge pricing, which will make all of their fans incredibly happy. For now, it's about Disney World in Orlando and Disneyland in California. Essentially, single-day tickets will be cheaper Mondays through Thursdays, more expensive on weekends and during the summer weekdays, and more expensive still on key holidays. At Disneyland, peak will be $119, and at Disney World, $124, or as I like to call them, $120 and $125.
Okay? I mean, I hate that dollar off thing. It's so annoying.
The Anaheim location pulls in some 17 million people a year, and the Orlando location, that one reaches some 20 million. Very big crowds for their capacity. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, I think. It's a modest change. It doesn't affect their heavy users. Those people come for 2 or 3 days and they buy packages, and those prices aren't rising this year. They do have an annual pass, which I think last year they raised 30%. They raised it a huge amount. They felt like it was really underpriced and too many people were using it. In fact, their parks are getting overstuffed. They're really bursting at the seams. And this is kind of a way for them to say, you know, we've got to tamp down on the people coming.
Yeah,
so casual people who buy single tickets last minute, they're like, we got to bump up the price a little bit. Every year, people yell and scream when they do it. They're mostly keeping pace with inflation, but with their annual pass increase and this one, to a degree, they're trying to maintain it so the crowds are not so big on the biggest days. They're trying to spread it out a little bit and try and tamp down. There's too many people in their parks.
Well, knowing many people who have annual passes, all of whom every year say, oh, should we do this? Because they get this annual pass and it's, you look at the list of rules and it's, well, I can go on Tuesdays, but not on Tuesday, what that falls on an odd day in the fifth week of a month. And if it's on a leap year and it, you know, so they're like, hey, but to give you some sense of why they might need to do this at, say, Disneyland. Okay. Disneyland in Anaheim, that entire park, including California Adventureland, which is also there, that entire park can fit in the parking lot for Disney World in Orlando, okay? And I mean this literally. You'd still have room left over in the parking lot in Orlando.
Yeah, and it's small.
It's very small. Now, listen to this. 17 million people per year going through there. In Orlando, which, as I just mentioned, is huge.
Yeah.
20 million people. So yeah, you can see why they might say, we don't necessarily want 70. We like the attendance, but it's getting a little too crowded. And it really is. It's pointless to go there now.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, I went recently and there was a 1 hour wait for anything.
There was or wasn't?
There was. Everything you wanted to do, there was at least an hour wait for. So
don't you have time things where you can get it and, you know, plan in advance and you get time tickets and all that sort of stuff?
Only for like one or two rides can you do that per day.
Three, I believe, but okay, if you're at a certain level.
Yes, you know. Correct.
All right.
Now, in a bungled, bad-for-business move, MSNBC marginalized anchor Melissa Harris-Perry until the host publicly called out the channel by refusing to appear on air until they either recommitted to her or admitted that her show was essentially canceled after weeks of being off the air, sidelined, and otherwise made to feel, as she put it, worthless. MSNBC admitted her show was actually indeed canceled, and now they're working out the details. The channel is in the midst of an overhaul to try and reboot the left-leaning brand during what could be a profitable election year. They may have wanted to do that last year. And anyway, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a short-term big deal. I mean, this is just as bad as it could be. With diversity all the rage, to treat a black female anchor this dismissively and poorly, and to the point where she felt like she was a guest on her own show because they were hosting the show in another city and she's appearing by satellite as a guest on her own show. It just is as bad as it gets, especially for MSNBC, which is supposed to be the liberal brand. You know, if anyone's supposed to get it right, it's them. And if anyone cares about it, it's their audience.
Earlier, we mentioned that Disney is raising ticket prices. In a way, the Metropolitan Museum of Art is lowering them. The publicly supported museum has always technically been open and free of charge to one and all, welcoming some 6 million visitors a year in New York City and a major draw for tourists. Wow, I did not realize that many people went through that museum.
Take that, Disneyland.
However, a lawsuit alleged that, in fact, under the terms of its deal with the city, it had no right to ask for any donations at all. That part of the lawsuit was thrown out, but now the Met has settled. They've agreed to change the signage at the Met so it asks for a quote-unquote suggested admission of $25 rather than a recommended admission. They've also changed the font size, so suggested would be the same size as admission.
It's not like suggested admission.
Right.
It's more like suggested admission.
Right. It's funny. In fact, you can just ask for a ticket, by the way, and pay nothing. Now, perhaps more people will realize that. Big deal or big whoop?
What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that when I was there, I was first shocked that it was now $25. I mean, when I lived in New York, it was like $6, $7, $8. And I'm not saying I lived in New York, you know, yesterday, but still, it never really went up. $25, that's a lot of money. And I did notice that it was basically saying, no, you know, you should probably pay this.
Yes, no, the culture is very bad. 6 million people is a lot. It's stuffed to the gills. So that's, again, part of it where, you know, if they had the capacity and they had the people, maybe they would feel less obliged to try and raise it and scare people away. But the fact is they have to change the culture because people have no idea that they're not supposed to pay $25. They think they have to. In fact, I don't because I go regularly. I'm not paying $25 every time I step into the Met for an hour. So I pay $5 or I pay a dollar. I pay nothing if I don't have any money. You know, hey, I'm not making a lot of money. So I'm like, I'm on a sliding scale. Let, you know, Gloria Vanderbilt pay a bigger price. You know what I mean?
Yes, indeed.
So as far as I'm concerned, that's a public space. They get all sorts of breaks from the city. They're not allowed to charge anything. You can go for free and you should because it's a great space. And if you don't have a lot of money, enjoy it. Because it's supported by a lot of tax dollars and a lot of things. So it's great that they've changed this little tweak. But what they need to do is change the culture so that the attendants don't – they often try to shame people into it. You know, like people are like, can I pay 10? And they're like, no. Well, the suggested price is 25. I mean, they really are aggressive.
You know, that is something else I noticed when I went. I actually said $25. I'm not paying $25. We're going to be here for like 10 minutes.
Right.
Because I was going for a very specific exhibit and I was only going to be there for a half an hour. So I said, okay, look, here's $10. I want to support the arts. And the box office cashier just like all of a sudden their whole attitude changed. Like, fine.
Right. Yeah. They're really bad. So
really?
This needs to be the first step in what they do.
Now, you thought Dick Van Dyke's Cockney accent was bad? Really?
Hello, Mary Poppins.
Well, Lin-Manuel Miranda may give him a run for his money. He's in talks to star with Emily Blunt in a sequel to Mary Poppins, with Miranda playing a street lighting fellow akin to Van Dyke's infamous Bert, a role that haunts Van Dyke to this day for the awfulness of his accent.
He can't go to England. He can't.
That's not fair. I mean, maybe Miranda can do a killer Cockney accent, but still... He seems a wildly unlikely choice for the part. Were no Brits available? I don't understand. And is there this a big deal or a big whoop? And my question is, does this mean he's no longer going to be playing Hamilton? And if so, when?
I think everybody's going to leave Hamilton after the Tonys.
I think you're right.
They've been doing it for a year and a half or 2 years now. They did it at the Public. They're on Broadway. It's been a long, long time to be in that show. And they're all, of course, have got getting, you know, offers out the wazoo. So I think they're all going to want to explore the possibilities. I'm sure some will stay of the key five or six actors, but there's going to be a big change after the Tonys. So if you have any chance at all and can afford it, but for heaven's sakes, try to get in there now.
Yeah, and I can tell you by any chance at all, they're sold out. Okay, so you're not going to get tickets on the regular market, you know, at the box office.
No.
And I can tell you that the tickets on the secondary market are absurd.
Right. And of course, there's counterfeit. They just announced in the papers, I think, that there was a sting. Some woman got ripped off. And so she set up to buy other tickets. And for some reason, the person showed up again. But she called the cops and they went with her. And the cop pretended to be her boyfriend. And the guy gave him the tickets and they slapped the cuffs on him. So at least somebody got arrested for trying to rip off Hamilton tickets. But anyway, Lin-Manuel is working on some songs for the movie Mary Poppins. He's the it boy. He did a song for the cantina scene in Star Wars. Now Mary Poppins is like, let's get Lin-Manuel. We need a song. Get Lin-Manuel Miranda. You know, everybody wants him. So he's already working on some tunes for the new Mary Poppins movie. So, of course, it's natural that they might want to work him into the film as well.
The daytime chat show, The View, has been renewed for its 20th season. I can't believe that show has been on the air for 20 years. But in a sign of how...
Tell it to Luke Perry.
Yeah,
I know. He's a dad now.
Twice. Yeah. Three times if you count Archie. Now, in a sign of how far Hollywood has to go to achieve diversity, the series is just getting its first female executive producer other than the show's creator, Barbara Walters. African-American Candy Carter has been the interim showrunner, and now it's official that she'll be in charge. Big deal or big whoop?
I mean, it's a big deal. You think about the strides that have to be taken. It's The View. You would think it would have been all executive female producers. You know, I mean, that's just that just tells you. I mean, Barbara Walters, I'm sure, has been there mentoring and focusing. She's been employing women. It's a show about women and led by women and hosted by women and created by a woman. And I'm sure there have been people at all different levels in directing and associate producing and all that. Nonetheless, even here on The View, they're still making strides forward. So that just tells you, imagine all the other shows and how much farther they have to go.
Adele's new album, 25. Did you know Adele had a new album, Michael?
I did not.
Okay, just checking. Yeah, she's got this new album. It's called 25, even though she released it when she was 27. A lot of the songs were written, you see, when she was 25. Okay. Well, that album may have been the best-selling album of the year last year, but it came out too late in the year to qualify for the Grammys. Expect to see it in the mix come 2017. That wasn't the case in the UK, where the Brit Awards showered affection on Adele, giving her album, song, Female Artist of the Year accolades. Plus, no one dropped a mic on a piano while she performed, so that kind of helped. Justin Bieber was International Male Artist of the Year, and if you're looking towards the future, Bieber is already an old man, by the way, at 21, although not a father. They named Catfish...
Not that he knows
of. So the Brit Awards named Catfish and the Bottlemen as the breakthrough act. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's the definition of a big whoop, but it's the Brit Awards. Just like the Grammys, it's a show to get to see people perform, and Adele gave a great performance, so you can still keep your tickets to her tour. After that disastrous Grammy performance, not to worry, she can still deliver.
And now, just to make our show half as long as the Oscar telecast, we should probably move along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some
of
the...
We may not make it.
I know, that's why I'm trying to like speed us along here. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I got to tell you, this story really will affect you because in a bold and shocking announcement, the bookstore chain Barnes & Noble announced it would be opening a string of physical bookstores. Bookstores you can go into, okay, physically. They're going to go toe-to-toe with their competitor, Amazon, which is reportedly planning the same tactic, opening up bookstores you can actually walk into, maybe thumb through a book, maybe spend the entire afternoon there reading all of the magazines that week. I mean, I would never do that, of course, but if I did, that anyway. Mm-hmm. When it was pointed out that Barnes & Noble already has a string of physical bookstores, they pointed to the internet-friendly style of the single bookstore Amazon opened up. Barnes & Noble planned to integrate online the physical bookstore, phones, and tablets in a somehow unified shopping experience. We call that the internet, my friends.
I don't know what's going on here. I mean, they're like, all right, Amazon did that. Okay. But I think they're trying to correct a problem, which is that I walked into Barnes & Noble to buy the latest Games of Thrones book. This is how old it is. You know, the latest book by George R.R. Martin, which was years ago. And I felt like an idiot because it came out that day. It was in a store and it was on sale, but I was paying like $6-7 more than I would have if I'd gone to barnesandnoble.com. It's like I'm being punished for walking into the store and picking up a book. So you feel stupid. And in fact, I was paying more if I bought it online physically than if I just bought the ebook the night before. So, you know, that disconnect between what you pay online and what you pay in a store, it happens for a reason. You know, it happens because it costs a lot of money to ship physical books around. So, you know, it's not like they're just being, you know, willy-nilly. But, you know, they've got a lot of problems. They've got the only sales that is growing is stuff other than books like toys and games and diaries. They revamped barnesandnoble.com and did a terrible job of it. It's been rectified since then, but it really was a disastrous relaunch of their website. So they didn't even get that right. So now they're trying to combine the two. It's going to be very, very hard. We'll have to see what happens.
Well, and one of the things that Amazon is doing, okay, is that there are no prices on the books because, of course, they change the prices a lot.
They fluctuate all the time, right? So, well, there are prices, physical prices on books. There's just no store prices as such.
Right.
Books have them sort of printed on the book itself, but that's not what you would pay. The store has their own sticker. And Amazon is just having it be a fluctuating thing so that you don't pay more in a physical store than you do online.
Before you move on to that, okay, this is the important part of that, okay, to find out what the real price is, because the, as you say, the price is on the book, that's the manufacturer suggested retail price.
Well, you got to scan it. You got to look at it.
You got to scan it with your phone. So what does that mean? It means that you've got a phone, they know who you are, they know which books you've looked at. In the store, they can follow you out of the store with that information.
Right. And if 2 weeks later you look at it online, they might have lowered the price by a dollar or two to try and tease you into actually buying it, because they know you looked at it in the store, but you didn't buy it. So they say, all right, you're sort of interested in The Revenant, that paperback. Well, all right, instead of $12.99, what if it was $10.99? And they know what's going to trigger you and make you say, okay, I'm ready to buy. So yeah, that information is very powerful.
Yeah, and that's how they do all of their testing. And they know, hey, you know what? You want to sell ebooks? Don't price them at $13.99. Price them at $9.99. And I can tell you, there is a book called Untangled. It's about raising teenage girls, okay? And you know, the psychology and sociology behind that. And it's a book I want to read for obvious reasons. I am on the cusp of that myself. And you know what? The ebook is $13.99. If that ebook were $9.99.
And how much is the physical book? Do you know?
It's not much more. It's like $16.99. Okay.
Oh, because nowadays you find that a lot of times that the ebook is more than the, especially in paperback, which drives me nuts. It's like, at least make it the same. Why the heck is it more? Yeah. So this is a book that just came out in February. It's list price of $27. It's on sale on Amazon for the hardcover for $17, or you can buy the Kindle ebook for $14.
And I can tell you, if
you're getting a few dollars less.
Yeah, and if it were $9.99, I would not have thought twice. Period. I would have. It would already be on the Kindle, but instead it's $13.99. Now I'm double.
Because you got used to it before when Amazon was deep discounting it?
Well,
you know, because they used to have all ebooks for $10. And you just got used to that price point.
I got used to that price point. I also think it's, you know what? It's more of a, yeah, okay, $9.99. Yeah, all right. It's not $10. It's under $10. But now you've already made me break out a $20 bill. Now I'm rethinking my purchase.
Right. So they're trying to bring the internet and the physical store together by keeping the prices in line a little bit more, so you don't have this bizarre disconnect between what you pay online versus a store. But hey, there's cost to shipping stuff around, which is why one other really disruptive thing that Amazon might do is say, hey, you want us to put your book on the shelf in our store? You have to give us print on demand. You have to give us a file so we can print out more copies of that book on demand. That means they don't have to ship and move and ship back tons of copies of books. This doesn't sound like a big deal, but it really is, because the margins in a store are smaller because they have to ship all those books around. But when you do print on demand, the margins for the seller are higher. So you make more money on a print-on-demand book because you haven't had to ship it in and ship it out and do all that sort of stuff. Print-on-demand was intended for rare, smaller titles, stuff you wouldn't normally have on display. But if someone asks for it, maybe you've got a machine and say, oh, you want that 1800 French book? Okay, we can print it on demand. But Amazon may very well say, hey, you want to be in our store, our physical store? You're going to have to give us that so we can have better margins, so we can keep it in stock. And that could really disrupt the business too. It's kind of hard to explain. You have to go into it a lot more, but it just avoids all that physical moving around of books.
Well, speaking of physical moving around,
it saves money, and it means, guess what? It's going to change the business in a really unexpected ways.
Speaking of moving things around and physically having to deliver items. So there's been these rumors that, Amazon might get into, you know, basically take over for UPS, either buy UPS,
they're going to do their own. They're doing so soup to nuts on delivery.
Yeah. So yeah, the other day I'm out in the driveway picking up the newspaper, and up the street drives an Amazon delivery truck. And
I've never seen that.
I don't mean like the Fresh Direct stuff where it's the grocery store stuff, because those are all over the place. Okay. That's not special. This was like an Amazon kind of DHL truck. Okay.
Right.
I actually waited 15 minutes for that truck to drive back past me, because I knew it would have to, because it's a dead end street. So I knew at some point it's going to have to drive. Sure enough, it drives back, and they have their own delivery trucks now.
I've never seen that.
Neither had I. I'd never seen that. So they really are. Look, you know what? They said,
gee, with the drones and with the
this whole concept of like data centers and having to build this massive infrastructure for technology is a big pain. You know what? We should actually just do it ourselves and then lease it out. Well, they could do the same thing with delivery.
Well, more importantly, they could just save the money of not having to pay someone else to deliver the book the half last mile.
That's true.
Of course, what they're trying to do. They're just saying, if we have the whole part of the chain, talk about a monopoly, then we can save money every step of the way. Yeah, perhaps they could sell it out to. Well, they're already doing that because other businesses put their products on Amazon and get delivered by Amazon. So, yeah, they're already doing that, you know, in a way, embedding those other businesses onto their website, and then they help deliver them. But, yeah, somebody was saying, oh, they've got these deals in North America for ports, for shipping and shipping containers and stuff into ports in the U.S. They've got the licenses and stuff. Oh, but you know what? They're going to need it in China, too, if they want to do. Oh, actually, they already have it.
Yes.
So they now have these deals in place for ports all over the world to deliver stuff. So, yeah, they are setting up their delivery world-spanning delivery system so they can take it from the factory right to your door, whether by drone or truck or who knows what.
But, you know, this story really started, and this should kind of be it's kind of indicative of what's going on with Barnes & Noble these days. It's a story about Barnes & Noble. What do? We start talking about Amazon. Okay,
exactly.
But Barnes & Noble actually trying to do something different, whether it's a good idea or a bad idea or whether they execute properly, they're at least realizing one thing. What we're doing right now is not working. So we have to change. We have to modify our business model. And that is at least a start.
Yeah, I'm surprised they're still around.
Barnes & Noble, yeah, as am I, to be honest.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, I believe that Amazon wants them around, because if they're not around, Amazon becomes way more of a monopolistic power.
Well, and it's hard, and it's a lot harder for people to know what books are out. People are walking to Barnes & Noble looking around than buying them on Amazon.
That's not true. I do it all the time. You know who I don't do it for?
Who?
French comics. Because last year, we reported on the controversy surrounding the French International Comics Festival. You might recall that. It came to a head when no women were nominated for the top prize, but apparently the festival has many problems. Attendance has been dropping. The running of it has been opaque, and last year's ceremony included a fake awards bit of humor that did not go down well, kind of like some of the jokes on last night's Oscars. Now, in an open letter that has been signed by virtually every major publisher in the field, that they say that they will be boycotting this festival until major changes take place. They've called on the French Minister of Culture, who is actually incredibly important in France, to name a mediator to work on the event with them.
And this is interesting because this is the only way things change, when everybody who's a player gets together and says, this has to change. If all the studios got together and said, hey, we need to work on this diversity thing, something might actually happen, you know? So in this case, when you've got all the publishers saying, guess what? We're not coming back until things change. Well, then things will change. So whatever problems are going on there with the festival itself, certainly with the representation of women, you can actually hope and believe that something substantial might happen to make real change down the road, because they've all come out and said, you know what? We're going to boycott it. That's the only way things happen.
Well, okay. Also, In publishing news here, the miniseries Roots in the 1970s was one of the biggest events in TV history. The remake launches May 30th of this year on the History Channel. So it's no surprise that the publisher of the Alex Haley book would put out a TV tie-in. Kind of makes sense. The new trade paperback of Roots hits stores May 3rd and costs $19.
Okay, so this fascinates me. This drives me nuts, talking about book pricing, which we did before with your book, Untangled. Why in God's name is a book that came out in the early 70s costing $20 in paperback?
Yeah, if it were like a nice collector's edition, hardbound.
But even that would drive me nuts, because it's like, it's 40 years old.
Yeah.
You know, this is a massively best-selling, Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. It hit number one in the 70s before the miniseries came out. I mean, it was a phenomenon even before the TV miniseries happened. It sold 1.5 million copies, which is a ton, before the show aired. So it was really a big, big deal even before this miniseries turned into just an absolute phenomenon beyond all belief. So they're remaking the miniseries. The paperback is coming out in stores, and this drives me nuts. It should be a mass market paperback. It should not be trade. It should not cost $20. It should cost $10. And it just drives me nuts. I really feel like they're pricing themselves out of the market. You know, they had Lee book prices of $10, And that was a little too low for hardcovers. Book came out in hardcover and they were like $25 list, maybe on sale for $17 or $18. But then was 60% cheaper on ebook. Well, ebook maybe should have been the same or a little cheaper, but that was too cheaper. And so people got upset, you know. But once it hits paperback, then the ebook should be even cheaper. You know, like they're really, they've got pricing messed up. This, there are so many books that I would buy or books that I think are missing their market because they charge through the roof. But there's other things going on here. One fact is that this book went out of print.
Okay.
Doesn't that seem bizarre?
Yeah.
Doubleday published the original book. It was one of the best-selling books of all time. And in fact, it came out through their Vanguard imprint. And this is kind of fun. The Vanguard imprint was sort of a, you know, we're going to do things differently. Instead of giving you a bigger advance, they offered you a higher royalty. Whoops. So for stuff that they weren't excited about, they didn't want to take a big risk, they'd say, we'll give you a bigger royalty. And Alex Haley said, okay. So that didn't work. That worked out great. It's just like Deadpool, you know? You can be angry and think, oh, if we hadn't given the author that deal, we would have made more money. You know what? You got the book out. You struck gold. That's what you should be happy about. Everybody wins when you do stuff like that, right?
I would hope so.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I think that was good for Deadpool. Maybe they regret it now. Oh, we should have paid Ryan Reynolds $5 million and not given him that deal. Don't be idiots. Be glad you got a big hit franchise. Be glad you got to make it for a price and it worked way beyond your wildest dreams. And because it was made cheaply, because they all took that risk, that's how you were able to make the movie that would work. Because if it had cost more and you were risking more, you may not have made the right movie and it wouldn't have worked because you would have been too scared and tentative.
What I say about Showbiz Sandbox every week, that if it cost more or you know, if we didn't do it for a price and we didn't keep the production costs down, we'd never be able to do it. You know, we wouldn't do it at all.
Right. So books going out of print. I'm glad that they did that royalty rate thing. That was a bold experiment. It worked because they were able to release a book that turned into gold. I can't believe they let it go out of print today. Every author has to look at their contract and say, what do we define as going out of print? Because no book ever goes out of print anymore, technically, because they're all available on ebook. So that's why they're all rewriting the contracts to determine when does a book go out of print. I'm not sure how Doubleday let this one lapse, but it's back in the day when they weren't promoting it and they weren't making it available in stores, eventually it would be considered out of print. That was a mistake. Now Perseus has picked it up. They published it in 2006, and now they've got the rights to it again. And now they're going to be able to make a lot of money when it hits the miniseries. So, you know, you've got copyright, you've got ebook pricing, you've got going out of print contract details. There's a lot of stuff wrapped up in this one little book, Roots.
Well, there's a lot wrapped up in our show each week, don't you think?
Absolutely. Thank God it's ending.
Oh, what? Not ending for good, but, you know, ending for this week. Speaking of which, next week we will be off because I will be traveling.
People don't know that Sperling surprises me every time he does this.
I totally
should have said it at the top of the show, you idiot.
I know, I always forget.
Oh my God.
We will be off next week, but then back the week after. It's not you, it's me. It's not you. It sounds like a movie.
Hey, how often I've heard that.
Just on the show, in fact. That said, I'm going to be in Alaska attending the Iditarod, which apparently everybody I tell that to says, what is that? But it's
really?
The Alaska sled dog race. Yeah, it's a 1,000-mile race across the tundra of Alaska from Anchorage all the way to Nome.
I know what the Iditarod is. You're attending the – how do you attend the Iditarod?
Well, you
go – I mean, you sit at the finish line and shiver?
That was actually one of the things we could have done, but instead we're actually going to just the start and the restart in Anchorage and a few of the waypoints at the very beginning of the race and then leaving, actually.
My next question is why?
We actually have friends and family who participate. So.
What?
Yes.
You have friends and family who participate in the idea? Are you friends with Sarah Palin?
No. Gosh darn no.
Really?
Have
they finished?
Yes. Yeah.
I don't know if that's a big accomplishment. I assume just finishing is a great accomplishment.
Oh, absolutely.
Participating is. Yeah.
I mean, right now they have 28 husky puppies that they're dealing with. So, yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay. You're going to the Iditarod. Well, good excuse. They don't have internet in Alaska.
I'm sure they do, but it's going to be cold. So I didn't know. I don't know what my schedule is going to be like. So
all right.
But you know what? You don't even have to worry about when the show is going to be, whether you miss a show or whether we're gone for a week, because if you just subscribe in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you know, it'll just show up in your feed and there will be. So again, iTunes, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to the show. Also ways to follow us. You can follow us on Twitter at showbizsandbox is our handle. And you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. And you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. I'd like to thank Ann Thompson for taking time out of her hectic schedule to join us to talk about the Oscars. We'll place links to her work in our show notes, so be sure to check that out on our website, again, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is MGMT.com. And Michael Giltz has a new website every week. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's ICanSeeRussiaFromMyHouse.com.
Wow, you must have really good eyesight. but you know what? If Michael, you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to MichaelGiltz.com where all of his coverage is aggregated. Of course, you can find it on the Huffington Post, or you could head on over to BookFilter.com. Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. And until 2 weeks from now, play nice.